In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
The spy and the devil. The untold story of the MI6 agent who penetrated Hitler's inner circle. It's a forgotten tale of MI6's top spy in Nazi Germany and his bid to stop the Second World War. It is a fascinating new read by Tim, or would I say Wilsey? And I'm delighted to say that Tim joins me live on the line now. Tim, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Ah, there you are. Sorry for one horrible moment. Good morning to you. So this book, The Spy and the Devil. Now, the listeners will be shaking their heads because they know I have a particular interest in this aspect of history, and I can talk until various cows come home. Explain a little bit about, because I've never heard this particular one. So set the scene about this incredible guy. Is it Baron Wilhelm de Rupp?
Yeah, that's right. Charles, you've never heard of it because it's never been told before. I discovered it in the pages of the authorized history of MI6. It's barely mentioned, only 6 pages out of 840 pages. And here is this guy. He, as you rightly say, he's a Lithuanian baron of German extraction, born in Dresden in 1886. And he became British in 1914, fought for the British in the First World War, and then returned, if you like, to Germany, to Berlin, and started spying against initially the Weimar Republic and then the Nazi regime. So, yeah, completely untold story and a fascinating character.
And who was, so what's it, so he's if you like, he's old school German, an old school German aristocrat. Did you say he was born in the Baltic? Sorry, was he born in Dresden but from a Baltic family?
Yeah, you make a really good point there, because the German aristocracy in the Baltic republics, Lithuania, Estonia and Latvia, had gone there in the 14th and 15th century. They were German landlords. They spoke German at home, and yet they were part of the Tsarist Russian Empire. So they didn't have German passports. They had Russian passports. And by the time you get to the early 20th century, the Russians are beginning to distrust them because they think of them as too German. The Germans distrust them because they think of them too Russian. The Lithuanians just think of them as rich landlords and want them out. And the Polish landlords think of them as Protestant, not Catholic. So they were disliked by everybody. So eventually these German landlords, most of them end up going back to Germany and fighting for Germany in the Second World War, and indeed in the First World War. Bill de Rupp was a little bit different. He changed his name from Wilhelm von der Rupp to the more acceptable Bill de Rupp. Sounded a bit more French than German.
Yeah.
Came to Britain, studied at Birmingham University, married a British woman, fought in the First World War in balloons over the Western Front. Incredibly dangerous job. But the great thing about him, he could speak absolutely fluent Russian, German, French, and English, 4 languages. Not just fluent, but to native level, i.e. he could pass as a German, he could pass as a Russian. That's a very, very unusual ability. And, of course, that's what allowed him to get close in to Hitler's inner circle.
He's fighting, correct me if I'm wrong, he's fighting for the Allies in the First World War, correct?
Correct.
Right. So, because I'm thinking, because this is where I start jumping up and down and my historical starts going off. But if he's coming from the Baltic states, then presumably Lithuania, Latvia, that's going all back to Teutonic Knights and heading towards the Baltics getting all those Teutonic Knight crusades of the 12th century. So therefore, you would think that his natural home would have been to go to Königsberg or to, East Prussia or something like that.
You're exactly right, and your history is spot on. This is all to do with the Teutonic Knights, and you're exactly right. But no, the interesting thing about him is, as I say, he went to Birmingham University, married a British woman, joined the quintessentially British middle class in a Wiltshire village, and was opening, a village fetes and judging tennis parties and things like this. He became quintessentially British. All these German aristocrats from the Baltics were looking for a new home.
Sure.
Most of them found it in Germany. Bilderot found it in Britain. Now, the really odd thing about it is when he was courting the Germans, and he knew Hitler very well too, and Hitler's ideologist, Alfred Rosenberg, he never tried to hide that he fought for the British in the First World War. He basically hid in plain sight. They just thought he was sympathetic to them, but he never hid that he had a British passport or anything like that. So it's an extraordinary sort of cover, if you like.
And I suppose the other thing is that because the Nazis, and don't take this the wrong way with this, Tim, and anybody else who's listening, but they are arrivists, aren't they? They are, a lot of the Nazis are from lower strata. They like nothing better than a punch up in a putsch in a beer cellar. However, they don't tend to be big fans of the old landed Germany, but they will kind of use them to their aims, and it's always good. I mean, people like Goering, for example, they're old school Germans. I mean, he's a First World War, he's got Blue Max, etc., hasn't he? So they like to flirt with the aristocracy as long as they don't have political power, sort of thing.
That's absolutely spot on. You're absolutely right. So when he starts cultivating the Nazis and he's trying to get to Hitler in various stages, it's a sort of five-stage cultivation. People pass him on to the next person in the chain. When he gets to Alfred Rosenberg, who is one of Hitler's inner circle, the Nazi ideologist, Rosenberg is actually Estonian. He also is from the Baltic, but he's not an aristocrat. So they have something in common. And Rosenberg rather looks up to Bilderot because Bilderot is an aristocrat. But as you rightly say, they were not wowed by aristocracy. They wanted to use aristocracy. And Bilderot's great skill was that he was very adjustable. So he wasn't a snob in any sense of the word. In fact, when he was in Britain, he worked in an engineering factory in Rugby and then another engineering factory in Hayes in Middlesex. So this was a guy who could mix in all sorts of social circles. And that was one of his great skills, of course.
This gentleman sounds like the ultimate sort of doppelganger shapeshifter. He can absolutely perfect spy material. And also another thing is the fact that if you are from the Baltics and you are aristocracy, then therefore it will follow that they will accept him into their inner circle because it doesn't matter if he's aristocracy. The one thing that the aristocracy hate more than anything else, apparently, are Bolsheviks and communists. So therefore, you're against the great sort of Jewish Freemasonic Bolshevik conspiracy.
Yeah, and indeed, Bill's main motivating force was his anti-Soviet, anti-communism. That was the thing that really, really drove him. And it was something he had in common with the Nazis until about 1936. I mean, don't forget, even in Britain, most people thought the Nazis were doing a remarkable job in the early 1930s. The economy was suddenly coming right. Hitler seemed to be restoring respect to the German nation. Factories were being built that were modern and impressive. So even Bilderot was impressed. But he starts to really worry around 1935, 36 and thinks, hang on. And this is incidentally the devil in my title. The devil is the transformation in the Nazi party to the evil party it became in the late 30s. And that's when he turned really against the Nazis. and you know, provided some of his best intelligence to MI6.
Because the thing is, I mean, as you said before, I mean, after the death of, it's von Ribbentrop. Is it von Ribbentrop or Bismarck? Is it Bismarck? I've got completely blank. It's a Bismarck or von Ribbentrop who's the Chancellor who dies and then Hitler takes over. The Germans. Well, Hitler takes over as Chancellor. The Germans, Speer takes over as Minister of overseeing sort of urban works. And Germany is seen as an example of getting young people back to work, a nation back on its feet, etc. It's all healthy living, Autobahns, gliders, these great youth marches. Everything seems to be very good indeed. And fascism seems to be the way to the future for several countries. You've obviously got Mussolini has put up fascism in Italy, and Mosley is trying to get something similar started in the UK as well. So yes, I mean, it's not, you know, presumably his first reports back to London, to Whitehall, just basically to let them know what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. And you make a very good point, you know. So, you know, I think it was Hindenburg, yes, was the
Hindenburg,
death.
Sorry, that's the one, thank
you. And Hitler takes over.
Yeah.
But curiously enough, and this is quite strange, given that anti-Semitism was quite strong throughout Europe, and even in Britain, in the 1930s, one of the things that turns Bilder up against the Nazis is the persecution of the Jews. He actually lives on the Kurfürstendamm, which was a busy social street in Berlin, but one with lots of Jewish businesses. So he saw firsthand a lot of the destruction of Jewish businesses. And in his first meeting with Hitler, he gets into a blazing row about the Jews, in which he says that actually a lot of Jews fought on our side in the First World War and did a very good job. And this sends Hitler off into a manic rage. So Bilderoth doesn't try that line again, but he fairly early stage recognizes that the Nazis have got a big problem as far as their attitude towards the Jews is concerned.
So how is he? I mean, you're saying he meets Hitler. I mean, how does he penetrate the circle then? Is it just through? I mean, is he seen as useful to? Is he? What's his cover story? Is he just swanning around being an astrocat, or is he helping the? Is he observing, you know, what's his cover story? Is it just because you're an aristocrat doesn't mean you can sort of swan in and say, you know, I'd like to hang out with Goebbels, or is it as easy as that?
No, it was. He had two interesting cover roles. Firstly, he was a journalist on the Times newspaper, and the Times was regarded as incredibly important by the Germans. And the Germans were very fed that the Times took what they thought was rather an anti-Nazi line, although actually in UK, people felt that the Times was rather too sympathetic towards the Nazis. And the other cover role he had is he was the local representative of the Bristol Aeroplane Company. And of course, that gave him marvelous access to the Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
And in 1937 and 1938, they actually let him into the factories to see the factories, because they think by showing him the factories, that it'll scare off Britain from going to war against Germany, because, you know, their factories, A, were so impressive, and their Messerschmitts and Heinkels were very, very impressive aircraft. Of course, it actually has the wrong effect, because Bilderoth takes in with him the chief engineer of the Bristol Aeroplane Company. And this chief engineer, a brilliant man called Roy Feder, is able to sort of view the factories and make calculations about the performance of the engines and stuff, and realizes that actually the Junkers engine and the BMW engine are not as good as the Rolls-Royce Merlin in the Spitfire and Hurricane, which we were frantically trying to build at the same time.
And of course, the other thing is the fact that of all the armed forces, I mean, the German army is sort of Prussian controlled, you know, aristocrats, but the Luftwaffe is, you know, you can get, you know, you are able to sort of get yourself an open door into there, aren't you? Because, I mean, as I said before, Goering is, you know, is aristocratic, and they're happy to show off. You know, I mean, one of Germany's, you know, Hitler flies over Germany, uses the aircraft as an integral part of his campaigns, isn't he? So they are more than happy to be showing off this new latest technology, aren't they?
You're absolutely right. And Bill's greatest friend in the Luftwaffe was the number two in the Luftwaffe, Field Marshal Erhard Milke, and he was actually Jewish. I mean, amazingly,
yeah.
He actually had a Jewish father. They concealed the fact, but he had a Jewish father. So, as you rightly say, he was able to get much better access into the Luftwaffe than he did into the Wehrmacht.
So 1935, he starts to realize that things, I mean, obviously you've got, you've got Kristallnacht, et cetera. You're seeing the eroding of all the liberties of the Jewish population. He, you know, is a man of conscience. He's sending, and presumably he's sending these things back via courier. I mean, I don't mean listeners by, you know, he's got a man coming with a van, but is he doing a dead drop? Is he sending signals back? How is he actually transmitting this information back without being caught out?
So two ways. Firstly, he travelled to London about three or four times a year. So he would come back and actually see people, which was the safest way of doing it, of course, just talking. But he also had an arrangement by which he could send material back through the MI6 station in Berlin. For example, there's a very interesting record of the MI6 officer being handed the glove of Bilderop's wife. And she says, "Feel how warm this lovely glove is." And he puts the hand in, and actually inside is some paper, which he then takes out and puts in his trouser pocket. So that's what I think they call in the trade a brush contact. So that's how he did it. One of the real problems is that he becomes aware of the Nazi threats, probably 35, 36. The British government is pretty slow. It's only really begin to realize 37, 38, hang on, that we're probably going to end up having to fight these guys. So, you know, his reporting wasn't taken as seriously as it should have been until we get to 37, 38, 39. And then, of course, it becomes really, really valuable.
Because, of course, you have Sudetenland, you have the abandonment of the Czechs to their fate, etc. I mean, this gets very dark very quickly for him. So is he suspected? Do people sort of start to look? Because the Nazis, by their very, I mean, Hitler's way of managing people is basically divide and conquer, and they're all fighting like rats in a sack to be, you know, top dog with the Führer. So does the glare of suspicion ever focus on our man, as it were?
Yeah, his cover begins to erode bit by bit. People start sending poison pen letters to Rosenberg saying, "Are you sure this guy's okay?" But Rosenberg genuinely likes him. Hitler, I think, respects him. He's got the sort of top cover of knowing Hitler. So you've got to be a brave German who decides you're going to arrest Bilderop. But no, you're right, absolutely right. His cover begins to erode. He begins to get very, very nervous. He tries to come back to UK in October 1938, but the chief of MI6 says, sorry, you know, this is too serious now. You've got to go back. And so he goes back, and he's very lucky. In September 1939, I mean, the very end of August 1939, 3 days before the Germans invaded Poland, Rosenberg says to him, "If I were you, Baron, I'd clear out of here." And he sort of gives him basically the tip off to get out, which almost certainly saved his life.
Wow. Where? And he was in Berlin at the time, or was he in somewhere else?
He was in Berlin.
Wow.
He was Berlin. He took the train down to the Swiss border. It was a very scary moment when crossing over into Switzerland, because the Basel railway station in Switzerland was actually run by the German railway system. So you thought you were in freedom, but actually it was the Gestapo monitoring the passports and so forth. So with huge relief, he manages to get through and into Switzerland. And then, instead of spending the night in Basel, knowing that, you know, it wouldn't take much for the Gestapo to cross the border and seize him from his hotel, they travel further, deeper into Switzerland, you know, to greater safety.
How did you? I mean, do you have? Are there letters? Presumably he doesn't keep a journal, does he, or something hidden? I mean, how do you find out what's going on sort of in the interior? You know, what were your sources to discover, you know, his fascinating story?
Very lucky in a way. Firstly, the first thing is I tracked down his grandson who lives in Tennessee. And when I flew over to see him, his grandson had pulled together everything from the family history he could find and put it on the dining table, including a remarkable photograph album given to his grandfather by Rosenberg himself. So that was a dream, followed by hours and hours and hours in the National Archives in Kew, and eventually finding I think I find 24 of Bilderop's reports, most of which are meant to be destroyed, and they're not actually meant to be kept in the National Archives, but they were discoverable there. And then going over to Germany and Lithuania and meeting the German family and talking about their view. And, of course, for many of them, they regard him as a traitor, even though, as I pointed out repeatedly, he was actually never a German national. He was only ever a Russian or a Brit. So he could not technically have been a traitor, but there's no doubt he did a great deal of damage to the Nazi regime.
It's interesting if you think they think he's a traitor, because, I mean, had the Bolsheviks come through or whatever later on, he would have undoubtedly been, you know, the entire family line would have been wiped out, presumably, you're thinking. As a writer who's doing history, when you walk into a living room in Tennessee and see everything laid out, including photograph albums, I mean, you must have smiled broadly, Tim, surely. Your jaw must have hit the floor.
It was like a child on Christmas morning, you know, with the stocking at the end of your bed. It was just unbelievable. And I said to myself, look, I'm tired. I've had a long flight. This can wait till tomorrow.
Yeah.
But of course, that resolution lasted about 5 minutes, and I was soon leafing through it all.
And the wonderful thing is, I mean, he lives to, it's early 70s, isn't it, when he passes away? He keeps going to the 70s.
Yeah. He lives to the 1970s. He's 87, I think, when he dies. He dies in a little village in England, Peterchurch, near Hereford. Everyone knew him as the old Baron. There were rumours in the village that he'd been a spy, but he never talked to anyone. He would be very polite. He would touch his hat with his cane and say good morning to people. And he was known mysteriously as the Baron, but no one sort of really knew him. He taught languages at Hereford Technical College.
Absolutely. Honestly, I mean, this is the thing about this particular... We are discovering, aren't we, more and more stuff about, as we celebrate the 80th anniversary of the end of the conflict in Europe, all these, even more of these stories, and people are saying, like, people say to me, why are you into history? It's all dusty and boring and dull. And I go, aha. And Tim, with this book, we are just still discovering so much, so many incredible people who did amazing things. And, you know, the story of Dirop is absolutely up there. And I've completely blown my little cotton socks off, Tim.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun talking to you about it.
What do you hope that people are going to learn from the book?
Well, you know, in all seriousness, there is some real contemporary relevance here as well.
Right.
I couldn't help writing about the guarantee to Poland without thinking of the Ukrainian backstop. I couldn't help reading the reports by MI6 saying we've got to rearm before it's too late without thinking of the parlous state of the British military in 2025. Again and again, one was coming back to things that ring so true today. And with Putin advancing inexorably westward across Ukraine, I think Bill Dorot would have been a very, very worried man.
The book is called The Spy and the Devil, the untold story of the MI6 agents who penetrated Hitler's inner circle. It's by Tim Willisey-Wilsey, who we're speaking to today. Tim, do you have a website? Can people find you online?
I think probably the best thing to do is find me on the King's College London website. Indeed, absolutely.
And you'll be able as well, listeners, to order it by clicking on the front cover of the book, which is just put on our Talk Radio Europe website. Go to the bookstore, click on the book, and it will be winging its way to you. The book is called The Spy and the Devil. It is the untold story of Hitler, the MI6 agent, who penetrated Hitler's inner circle. It's by Tim Willisey-Wilsey, who's speaking to you today. Tim, can I just speak? It's been an absolute eye-opener, and thank you so much for bringing this amazing story to our attention.
Great to talk to you and your listeners.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.